the amount of capital that can flow into this space, boy oh boy, it's mind-bending to think what we've got in front of us. I think there's roughly 50 trillion in funds under advice. I think we're going to get probably close to 5% of that to come into Bitcoin. That's $2.5 trillion that's going to fit into roughly a $500 billion market cap. If you think that there's only 1 million coins on exchange, you basically divide $5 trillion by 1 million Bitcoin, and I think you end up with $5 billion of Bitcoin. What we're trying to do is literally get every Bitcoin off exchange, and we need an army of plebs to deliver that to the world, because I don't see a higher calling for me. I think from a dollar perspective, the biggest rug pulls are in front of us. Billion or trillion dollar rug pulls, I think, are well and truly in front of us.
Before we get into the episode, I have to tell you about the simplest and best way to start mining Bitcoin, the Blockware Marketplace. Our new streamlined onboarding process means you can literally buy a Bitcoin mining rig and start mining in under 60 seconds. All of the machines available for sale on the marketplace are online right now at one of Blockware's facilities. You don't have to worry about lead times or finding a place to get your machine plugged in. Blockware has already taken care of that for you. You get to mine completely hassle-free. And if at any point you decide that you no longer want to mine, or if the price of ASICs increases and you want to capitalize on the higher value of your machine, you can list your rig for sale at any time and at any price. This platform has completely changed the landscape of hosted Bitcoin mining. And the best part is that this all takes place using Bitcoin and the Lightning Network. Get started today at marketplace.blockwaresolutions.com. This video is sponsored by Stampseed. You plan on holding your Bitcoin for decades, so you need to make sure that your seed phrase is documented in something that can last just as long. Stampseed's signature titanium plates and stamping kits do just that. If you simply write your Bitcoin seed phrase down on a piece of paper, it's vulnerable to fire, water, and all sorts of erosion that can happen over time. Make sure you keep it secure for years to come. Head to stampseed.com and use the code BLOCKWARE15 for 15% off the entire website. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Blockware Podcast. This week, I'm excited that we have the biggest Bitcoin bull I've ever met, Peter Dunworth. Peter, welcome.
Pleasure to be here with you, Mitch.
This is an interesting time for both of us because we're across the world, so I think it's 10 p.m. your time. It's 7 a.m. my time. I just rolled out of bed, but I'm ready to rock and roll. I want to start. You're building the Bitcoin Advisor, and I swear, every time I go on Twitter, you guys are announcing a new hire, somebody in Bitcoin that's like really popular that I've been following for a while. So you're putting together this army. What are you doing over there, and what's your plan?
It's a really simple plan. We just want to help get every single Bitcoin off exchange. And, we think collaborative custody is a way to do that. It's a way to protect newbies to Bitcoin. It's a way to protect new clients. It's a way to help literally see every single Bitcoin off exchange. I think, and I don't profess to have all the answers when it comes to self-custody, but I think what the Bitcoin Advisor does deliver is it provides a number of guardrails, safety rails that help take newbies to Bitcoin and help them with a self-custody solution, which we think has got the best possible trade-offs. And this is where for all of these Bitcoiners out there, and I know your listeners out there are, hardcore Bitcoiners who have their own self-custody set up and the rest of it. I don't attest to make any provisions on how anyone should set up their own Bitcoin self-custody arrangements, but what I do understand very well is that collaborative custody has a number of trade-offs that ensure multiple redundancies are built into a protocol that ensure you won't lose your Bitcoin. And for clients who are new to Bitcoin and don't understand key cryptography and private keys and the rest of it, it's probably a great place to start your self-custody journey. So what we're trying to do is literally get every Bitcoin off exchange, and we need an army of plebs to deliver that to the world, because I don't see a higher calling for me at this point in time. So that's what we're doing.
That's very noble. I've always thought that Bitcoin going off exchanges is really how the number actually goes up, because as long as it's on the exchanges, they can potentially rehypothecate and play all these fiat games. So definitely that's a noble project you're building. Can you talk about some of these trade-offs with collaborative custody? Like what might be the downside? Why might somebody not want to do collaborative custody?
That's a good question. I think collaborative custody and some of the innovations and improvements that are coming to collaborative custody will mean that the majority of people will will come to collaborative custody moving forward. I think there's a perception, and you know, one that served the Bitcoin community for years up until this point, is not your keys, not your coins. And there is a misconception that with collaborative custody, you lose control of your coins or your keys. And so the key distinction with collaborative custody is that not only do you have full control of your coins, you've got full control of your keys, but you have some fail safes in place that if you're looking after a large amount of Bitcoin, a high percentage of your net wealth is in Bitcoin, or alternatively, your family's relying on you solely for the custody of that Bitcoin and something happens to you, the most important thing you can do is have an estate plan protocol in place that's going to recover those Bitcoins. And this is where our understanding and our knowledge in collaborative custody helps building out estate plan protocols for all Bitcoiners. That helps them recover their Bitcoin in the event of an untimely death. And this is where I think as you get a higher percentage of your net assets in it, or alternatively your life circumstances change where you've got a family or children that you need to provide for, and this is what the Bitcoin's ultimately for, is providing for that family, a collaborative custody starts to make a lot more sense, that you don't want the sole responsibility of ensuring that your wife is able to access a single SIG device and, you know, all of the cons that go along with that. So having a team of professionals to help support your loved ones if you're not there to access your coins seems reasonable.
Yeah, definitely. So how, walk me through the exact process then. So let's say I'm your client and I have a key, you have a key, and then does some third party have another key? And you know, what happens if I die? How do my loved ones get access to that Bitcoin?
Great question. So we're platform agnostic when it comes to the multi-sig providers. We work with all of them. So we've worked with Casa, Nunchuck, Unchained. There's some new multi-sig providers coming through in Thea and Keeper that are offering some really innovative solutions. And this is where, you know, depending on what your circumstances are and what you'd like to, you know, how easy you'd like to make the process depends on what multi-sig provider that we'd use. To take, for instance, say Nunchuck, they're quite innovative. They've got a great, you know, phone app that you can use. They've got the flexibility to have a 2 of 3 or a 2 of 4 multi-sig setup, which is really interesting. And then you compare that to a trade-off, say, with Unchained, which is a 2 of 3 setup. And some people like the fact that Unchained is an American-based organization with the property rights afforded to all American companies. There's, you know, that's really hard to deny. And there's some, you know, benefits to that too. So depending on what the client's circumstances are, we'll set up the multi-sig provider that's best for them. And typically what happens is the multi-sig provider holds a key, you hold a key, and we set up that hardware wallet, whatever type of hardware wallet you wish. And then we would hold a redundancy key in that 2 of 3 setup so that if something were to happen to you and you fall off a, you know, fall in front of a bus and you're no longer there. What we would have set up is basically an estate plan protocol, which would give it's a formal document which you can leave at the back of your last will and testament. That is a document that your executor of your estate can action. It will have a whole host of items that the executor would need to provide, whether it's Unchained or Nunchuck or ourselves, as far as documentation to prove that basically you're no longer with us. And quite simply, that documentation looks something along the lines of a notarized death certificate for yourself, a notarized copy of your last will and testament, a notarized copy of ID for the executor, and a notarized copy of the beneficiaries. And then together with the multi-sig provider and ourselves, if your estate, your executor, your beneficiaries, or your children weren't able to access any of your hardware devices or seed words for your multi-sig setup, we can take instruction from your executor, and Unchained or Nunchuck and ourselves can action a transfer to your estate.
Interesting. So really the only way this could go wrong would be if like something happened to me and you at the same time, right?
Yeah. And we've got some pretty good protocols in place to ensure that I'm never in a room with you. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. We've got multiple redundancies that if something happens to me, we've got multiple backups. So we're mm-hmm. building out a pretty good team there. And the team is very knowledgeable. I consider myself extremely fortunate to work with some of the people that we do that I consider them far better Bitcoiners than myself. But together, we're just trying to help get clients into a collaborative custody and get coins mm-hmm. off exchange.
Yeah, part of what I've noticed with your team is you keep hiring like from all different parts of the world. Is that a certain was that intentional with that geographic distribution?
Yes, because we've got clients from all over the world. So one thing that we've noticed is that there is a real fear amongst Bitcoiners about that concern around passing Bitcoin to the next generation. How are they going to pass it to their loved ones? And this is a common problem. It's not a want. The service isn't a want. Oh, it's a nice to have. I'd like to have it. It's if you're a Bitcoiner and you've got a substantial amount of your wealth in it, and your family's relying on that wealth to provide for them if you're not there, then all of a sudden this service isn't a want, it's a need. And so we've got clients literally all across the globe, from Asia through to Europe, UK, Ireland, North and South Americas, Asia, New Zealand and Australia. So building out a geographically dispersed team is really critical to make sure that we can service those clients in different time zones. Makes team meetings a little difficult, but we're working on that.
Yeah, I'm sure that's a problem. It also, I feel like it offers a nice trade-off, right? Because I could have, you know, let's say I have a key here where I'm at, and then I go to you and your company, and there's a key on a different continent, and then the other third party could be on a different continent. So it just makes that multi-sig geographic distribution a lot easier. The analogy I love to use is Voldemort's Horcruxes from Harry Potter, if you've ever seen that. They're all over the world, and they have to go around to different places to destroy them. That's what you would have to do to take someone's Bitcoin out of a multi-sig setup like that. So I think that's an interesting framework. How do you view the spot ETF as it pertains to custody? Because obviously, it's not real Bitcoin, but it's still, I mean, it's bullish, right? Because you're going to get a lot of these capital inflows, but I know a lot of people view it as this giant honeypot that could get seized by the US government or something like that. So what are your overall thoughts on the spot ETF?
In short, I think it's wildly positive for Bitcoin. I think it's going to bring a lot of attention to Bitcoin. It justifies Bitcoin's existence, and it gives some recognition that it hasn't had in traditional markets up until this point in time. In the last week, we've seen Larry Fink change his opinion completely over the last 4 years from, you know, Bitcoin's used for money laundering to now talking about Bitcoin being a flight to quality. And if you had asked me 3 years ago or even a year ago that Larry Fink would be on national TV telling people that Bitcoin was a flight to quality, I mean, I just wouldn't believe you. That is insane to think that he believes that. And yet here we are. You can check for yourself. Just look up CNBC, Larry Fink, flight to quality. And there he is saying it. So I think what's most important about this is it's going to bring attention to Bitcoin, and all of a sudden it's going to bring a whole host of institutional and retail asset flows into Bitcoin. This is going to be really good for Bitcoin from an awareness perspective. And then our job as Bitcoiners is to educate people why holding Bitcoin in an ETF is inferior to holding Bitcoin in self-custody. So I think it's beholden upon us to educate the masses as to why you want to be self-custodying your Bitcoin, but it's going to be really good for bringing attention to Bitcoin. So I think it's going to be a double-edged sword, but you know, the amount of capital that can flow into this space, boy oh boy, it's mind-bending to think what we've got in front of us.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think as this capital flows into this space, it just creates that much more opportunity for people to build collaborative custody solutions like you're building, right? Because that's a need, it's not a want, it's not a nice to have. Like, we need these kind of products. So as the Bitcoin market cap grows, there's just all this much, you know, stronger incentive to people to solve those problems. So I think in the short term, in the short term, it could be a problem with custodial, you know, people holding the ETF instead of Bitcoin. But I think over the long run, you're going to get people to shift to self-custody, especially as these products get built out, because it won't happen overnight. The entire world isn't ready to get onboarded to self-custody tomorrow, but maybe 5-10 years from now, they should be. This is a conversation I was having with Smeet last week. You mentioned his company, Theia. Do you think the biggest rug pulls are behind us or in front of us?
In front of us, for sure. On a dollar value perspective, absolutely in front of us. Mm-hmm. If you look on a Bitcoin, like the number of Bitcoin rug pull, that's questionable because, you know, Mt. Gox was just such a behemoth in the day. It had 80% of volume. So I think from a dollar perspective, the biggest rug pulls are in front of us. The amount of Bitcoin though might actually be behind us. So $1 billion or $1 trillion rug pulls, I think, are well and truly in front of us. That's just a matter of time. And if, you know, I think a lot of people are concerned about the ETF sort of bringing in that ability to rug pull. I'm not so concerned about the ETFs bringing in that ability to rug pull, because I think the SEC does a relatively good job of regulating that and ensuring they've got what they think they've got. I don't think that's where the problem's going to happen. I think where the problem's going to happen is when fractional reserve banking gets their mitts on those Bitcoin. That's where the rug pull's going to happen. They're going to find out that there's a hard stop on Bitcoin of 21 million, and they're going to try and rehypothecate because bankers are going to bank, and they're going to figure out that there's no way to cut this cloth. So that's where I
I
think the
mean
rug
that,
pull happens.
and that'll probably be a bigger teaching tool than anything you and I can tell people, is when they are actually the victim of one of those rug pulls. It's going to be interesting. Yeah, I definitely tend to agree. The on a dollarized basis, the biggest rug pulls are surely in front of us. You have an interesting idea, and you shared this with me at Pacific Bitcoin, and I'd love for you to explain it. What is the App Store for keys?
I love this idea. I'm glad you brought it up. To me, I think this is a way how we onboard the world and we make collaborative custody a global phenomena that ensures that we can self-custody every Bitcoin rather than leaving Bitcoins with institutions. The App Store for Key is a really simple idea that is using the existing knowledge and reputations of Bitcoiners in the space at the moment to offer their private key for a multi-sig setup. And what I envisage happening is that you can go to an app store that's got everyone's key in there. So Mitch, your key would be in there, my key would be in there, we might get Joe Burnett's key in there, Preston Pysh's key, and some other famous Bitcoiners in there. And we've got basically a choice of keys that we can use to set up our own quorum of a multi-sig vault. And so each of these keys would have a different cost to use them. And so you, as the key holder, would charge a certain amount. You might be offer a premium service where you charge $100 a month to use your key, and I'd pay you $100 a month to use your key in my quorum. People might pay me $10 a month for my key in my quorum, and different people would pull different keys into a quorum that they'd build and help themselves. And then at a future point in time, if we needed signing, then there would be a fee to sign. But what this is basically leveraging off the network smarts and all of the experience that the Bitcoiners have in the space at the moment to help build out a collaborative custody environment and leverage off the reputations to not only monetize their knowledge and reputation that they've got now, but also to help clients self-custody on a global scale.
It's an interesting idea for sure, because you can basically, like, I'm a pretty like not super well-known Bitcoiner, so maybe I only charge, you know, $5-$10 a month for my key, but someone like Preston Pysh or Jack Mallers, who's like really well-known, really well-trusted, they could charge much more. So it creates an interesting like free market dynamic there. And there's all sorts of options too on like how often will you sign, right? Maybe my services will allow me to sign once a month, or someone else to sign once a year. You pay more to have more frequent signings, but like most Bitcoiners, I'm not moving my Bitcoin like hardly ever. So I wouldn't really need a signature once a month. So there's bajillion different options, and I'm really glad you shared this idea with me.
Yeah, I personally would like to go for charging $10,000 a year for not signing, only signing once a decade. And it's kind of an insurance policy that if you need my signature, you know, you get one a decade, but it ensures that you're going to be hodling for that period. So this is all of a sudden an interesting dynamic that I think helps serve that purpose to help get Bitcoins off exchange, but help clients and help people who are new to Bitcoin safely self-custody their Bitcoin, because they're surrounded by an army of really experienced Bitcoiners who are, you know, very familiar with securing cryptographic keys.
What do you think? I've always thought that the biggest hurdle to self-custody was just the fact that people have to take personal responsibility. Not that it's necessarily challenging or difficult to do. Do you think humanity in general will be able to overcome that fear and like actually want to possess their own asset. You know, Bitcoin is a bearer asset that you can hold yourself, unlike stocks, unlike cash in the bank account, bonds, anything else. You don't have to manage it, and the risk isn't on you. Do you think, would you agree that that's the biggest hurdle, is that mental barrier? And do you think people would ever be able to overcome that?
Yeah, I think it is a huge hurdle. I think there's a number of hurdles, and I'm not sure if it's just the responsibility that one has to take to self-custody your Bitcoin. But I also think, you know, if we look at, say, where the bulk of wealth is at the moment, it's in the boomer generation. And you look at and consider someone who's 65 years of age, they're not particularly tech savvy. And then you look at the learning and the amount of hours that's required to get comfortable with self-custody. Personally, I would put that at somewhere between 50 to 100 hours that someone needs to invest in getting really comfortable with self-custody. And that's for a small percentage of their net wealth. And then as that net wealth grows and goes exponential, then you probably want to be working closer to somewhere between 100 to 1,000 hours of effort and intent in learning that setup. Now, I look at baby boomers and I think, what do they have a lot of and what don't they have a lot of? They've got a lot of money and they don't have a lot of time. They do not want to spend 1,000 hours learning how to custody their wealth. They're not going to do that. It's just flat out, no way, no thanks. Just give me a service that I'm prepared to pay for and I'll let them do it. And this is where those people who don't have the time or don't want to take the responsibility, I look at and think the collaborative custody is an ideal solution for solving two of those problems. It solves the knowledge gap that they've got and it solves the responsibility that they want to take. So, you know, with all types of custody that we look at with Bitcoin, you know, there's no solutions, only trade-offs. And this is where I think collaborative custody is one of the things that is going to move the needle on adoption. And if I look at, you know, who's really self-custodying Bitcoin at this point in time, I think we're limited to maybe 0.1% of the population. I don't think it's any greater than that. So if we're going to move the needle on adoption from 0.1% all the way through to 10 or 20%, I think collaborative custody holds a really, well, is our best way of doing that with the trade-offs that it makes.
Yeah, I tend to agree. One thing I'm curious if you have an understanding on is these institutions like Coinbase, when they're custodying large amounts of Bitcoin, or, you know, other entities that have really high quantities, a lot of Bitcoin, and they're qualified custodians, right? I think people assume there's just, they have this magic wand that they don't have to really figure anything out. It's super easy. How are they custodying Bitcoin? What sort of safeguards do they have in place? Is it like a 5 of 9 multi-sig? Do you have any insights on what that might look like?
I've got some insights, as my brother used to run an exchange, and there was a multi-sig that they were running. There were multiple authorities that had the ability to sign. And this is where I look at some of the innovations that are coming down the pipe in multi-sig, whether it's time locking or alternatively a hierarchy of keys. And then the other one that's really interesting to think about is the decaying multi-sig. All of a sudden, these three things from an institutional custodian perspective is very important. And, you know, they're probably looking at that sort of stuff now, but it's going to be probably 1 to 2 years, maybe even 3 or 4 before those concepts hit the prime time for retail. And then all of a sudden that totally disintegrates any reason why you wouldn't want to be doing collaborative custody. So I think collaborative custody will be the way forward. Multi-sig will be, you know, a key component of it for those, you know, warehousing or, you know, storing large amounts of Bitcoin on a personal level or an institutional level. And I think, you know, we've got a lot of innovation happening in this space. And I was just thinking about this the other day. The innovation happening on Bitcoin is getting to a point where I don't have time to keep up. And so my sole focus is really focused on that multi-sig, you know, collaborative custody environment and all the tech innovation that's happening there. And I'm finding myself struggling to keep up with that from that capacity. So God knows what else is happening on every other part of the network, but that's my little lane that I stay in, and I'm hugely buoyed by what's coming down the pipe.
Yeah, you're following Michael Saylor's first rule for life, which is to focus your energy. There's hundreds of good ideas, but you found the great idea that you want to focus on, which is collaborative custody. So hats off to you. Can you explain, so you mentioned it was time locking, hierarchy, multi-sig, and then decaying multi-sig. Can you explain each of these and, you know, how do they actually work?
Sure. So there are different types of time locking, and what a time lock basically looks at is either locking your keys to a certain block height or a point in time in the future, which is it's a great security feature in that, you know, you can basically lock your Bitcoins in what I've effectively called absolute cold storage. It's as cold storage as can be, because you can't move those Bitcoins, even if you have the private keys, until it reaches the block height or the point in time in the future that you're ready to move them. So from a safety and security perspective, it's probably the safest form of Bitcoin that you can hold in cold storage.
Do you like broadcast a transaction basically that won't be valid until X block height?
There are multiple ways to do it. There's, I think it's BIP65, where you can broadcast a transaction to a block in the future. Or alternatively, some of the innovation that's happening with Miniscript is a time locking function that enables your Bitcoin to be time locked with a certain private key for a period of time, and then it goes away. So the time locking function that I just described that's available with Miniscript, and you know, kudos to Rob Hamilton and Becca there that are leading the way there, as well as the Wizard Sardine team. They're leading the market in that, and this is almost a merge between a time lock and a decaying multisig. So what does that mean, and what is a decaying multisig? So in a multisig, you're using, say, two of three keys, and you can use any two of the three private keys to sign a transaction and do that. With a time lock or a decaying multisig, you might remove the function for two of those three keys to sign at some point in time after a two-year period. You might say, well, if Bitcoin hasn't moved in this vault in 2 years, we're going to degrade that two of three multisig down to a one of three multisig. So all you need is one of the three keys to move the coin. And this is a great security feature, because all of a sudden it reduces the hurdle rate of ensuring the two of the three private keys. Mm-hmm. So it gives you some fail-safe if you kind of mess up your key arrangement on a personal level. The other thing with the hierarchy of keys, and that time locking function again works in this way, is that you can nominate a private key as effectively the master key in any transaction, that in a certain 2 year period or 1 year period or 1 month period, that any transaction from this account needs to use this private key to do that. And so the exciting thing for me is that when you combine the time locking hierarchy of keys and the multisig or decaying multisig, all of a sudden, when you combine those three things into a functioning multisig wallet, and this is probably a bit technical, but what it does is that removes any concerns that you could possibly have about not your keys, not your coins. So all of a sudden, it totally removes any concerns that you'd have or reasons not to use collaborative custody.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And all of this just really makes me think, like, this is the benefit of having digital property over analog property. You can't do any of this with gold or land or anything else like that. Having this programmability and to be able to create all these features and safeguards, who knows what we don't even know is going to come in the future, right? All of these are great ideas that exist in 2023 when Bitcoin is 14 years old. Imagine when Bitcoin's 140 years old. There should be all sorts of different cool ways to keep your Bitcoin safe and secure, but also use it in like a day-to-day fashion. This is really fascinating.
Yeah. It's wild.
Yeah. We can shift gears here, because you're also a financial advisor, right? And I'm sure not all of your clients are probably 100% into Bitcoin. So what do you say to those that aren't? And what do you really think is the right Bitcoin allocation? And I'm sure that probably varies based on individual circumstances.
That's a really broad question. I've been very successful in asking all of our clients, bar one, maybe two clients, to buy Bitcoin. So I've been very successful in that capacity. When it comes to the weighting to a portfolio, I think that comes down to a very personal preference and your risk tolerance, because Bitcoin's so volatile. And this is the problem that we have, is that, you know, people misunderstand and misappropriate volatility for risk, and they think that Bitcoin's really risky because it's volatile. And it's really important to make that distinction. I spend a lot of time with clients explaining the difference between risk and volatility, And once they get comfortable with the fact that it's not a risky asset, it's just wildly volatile, then we can start putting an allocation together. And this is where, if I look at the historical context of how we used to advise clients over the last 7 years on this, we used to start clients off with an allocation of 1 to 2%. And it was a very simple justification because it wasn't a financial product. It was very difficult from a compliance perspective to advise on anything greater than that. In addition to that, clients looked at that and said, oh, 1 to 2%, that's kind of a level of risk that I'm happy to take with this magic internet money. And 7 years ago, it was magic internet money. And you look at that and you think, okay, a 1 to 2% allocation back in 2016, it's probably gone up somewhere between 30 and 50 times in that 7 years. And so all of a sudden, 1 to 2% now is a large percentage of their wealth if they haven't sold. And this is where that conversation looks very different today, because now with Larry Fink coming out and saying it's a flight to quality, well, a flight to quality means that you can start allocating somewhere between 10 and 25% if you want to get really aggressive with an allocation with clients. And this is where, on a personal level, if we're talking to families that we advise on, we typically start with the advice that they should put somewhere between 5 and 10% of their net assets into Bitcoin. And what you find is over time, those assets will grow significantly. And we've had clients who have weightings of over 60% of their net assets in Bitcoin. And that's
Nice.
really a function of time.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. If you buy Bitcoin now and you just HODL, it's going to take up a larger percent of your portfolio because it outperforms every other asset class. And the idea that you're talking about with Larry Fink, I think it's just so incredibly bullish. It's not even the fact that, you know, we're going to get this ETF that'll make capital inflows that much easier. It's just the confirmation. It's the look that this gives from Wall Street, because, you know, we can sit here and talk about Bitcoin all day, people on Twitter, and we can have our podcast. But until you get Wall Street giving it the thumbs up, most people aren't going to be willing to put in a large percentage of their net worth.
They're not. And you know what? The financial planning world doesn't really understand that right now either. Like, I spoke to a financial advisor mate earlier in the week, and I said, did you see Larry Fink said it was a flight to quality? He's like, no. I'm like, yep, sent him the video, and holy dooly, oh my goodness, that was a week ago. So the other thing I don't think Bitcoiners really comprehend is the magnitude and the weight, the sheer weight of money that is going to come into this space. It is just a fire hose that's going to come in. And if you look at traditional flows, you look at how the pension systems are set up around the world, that's typically where a lot of the money resides, whether it's either in a pension system or an insurance system, both very closely related, work hand in hand. You look at the boomers who have, you know, the majority of assets globally. You look at the pension systems that they're in. They're typically in a 60-40 bond portfolio, and they're going to be selling those down to create the annuity streams that they require. You compare that, or, you know, you juxtapose that to, you know, anyone who's under 50 or under 60 who's got a pension that they're trying to build up or add additional capital to. What are they going to allocate money to? They're going to allocate money to Bitcoin. And all of a sudden, you're going to have huge volumes into that. At the same time, you're going to have huge outflows out of the bonds and traditional assets. And there's going to be this, you know, surge in asset values. And the other thing that's really important to note about the ETF is that money is really sticky money. It's not fast money. Like, the moment, you know, up until now, you've had hedge funds, you've had day traders, you've had anyone with an edge, anyone with any trading nous whatsoever, in and out of Bitcoin, moving money at the speed of light. And the money that flows from these ETFs is sticky money that is typically put aside by an investment advisor who's got a 5 to 10 year plan for that money. And they say, right, we're sticking a 5% allocation in, and we're going to leave it there. And so it sticks there. It's not going to come in and out. So all of a sudden, that money's going to go in. It's going to be a one-way lever. And on top of that, you're going to have additional pension contributions on a yearly basis going into that. It's going to be a lot bigger than we think it could be.
So, do you think we've probably had our last 70% drawdown bear market?
Oh, good question. No, I don't think we're ever going to get out of that cycle. Even when we hit a super cycle, I think we'll have a 70% drop off. Like, I just think that's human nature.
Wow, I mean, imagine we go from 10 million to 3 million. That's oof. That'll wipe some people out, I can imagine.
It's going to happen again. I've got no doubt about it. And you know, you look at the catalyst for what is the type of, you know, how does Bitcoin even sustain that level of, you know, that level of capital? It's really simple. It's just a demand supply dynamic. You either get all the Bitcoin off exchange so there's none to buy, or you just put a weight of capital into the demand side, and we're going to meet somewhere in the middle where we'll probably end up, I would have thought, in the next 2 years having 1 million coins run off exchange because the ETF will buy 1 million coins.
Yeah.
And now we're down to 1 million coins on exchange, and we've got increased daily flows into Bitcoin over and above what we ever thought possible.
Yeah, I think I got two thoughts on that. And one, with the bear markets, I think the best framework I've heard is from Joe Burnett. It's the energy gravity, right? As Bitcoin, if Bitcoin does 100x tomorrow, at some point it doesn't make any sense to buy spot Bitcoin instead of a spot ASIC. And so you just get all those capital inflows into mining instead of going to Bitcoin, which causes this bear market. And then as hash price or hash rate increases, miners are having to sell more Bitcoin. And then another thought I'm having here, you mentioned in a tweet, I think you were talking to Luke Mikich, it's the multiplier effect, right? So the Bitcoin market cap right now, $600-ish billion. Of the Bitcoin that's actually on exchanges, that's probably only $100 billion. And so if, you know, $10 trillion comes into Bitcoin via the spot ETF, that's not going to be $10 trillion plus $1 billion. Can you explain how this is going to work and what you think the net multiplier might be?
Yeah. So I'll give a historical example, and this is going to be really loose. Someone fact check me and tell me how wrong I am, and this is what the internet's the best at. But just an example off the top of my head, I think it was April 2020 or 2021, there was a fat finger trade of $100 million purchased on spot. Someone just basically did a fat finger trade. That $100 million purchase sent the market cap of Bitcoin up $40 billion in the next 24 hours. So an excess trade of $100 million had a 400 times increase in the market cap. That's $100 million fat finger trade. Now, if we look at the flows and where the flows can come from and think about, you know, what is possible, I think that's an outlier because it was a fat finger trade that happened in a split second, and then that just threw the market out and sent all the algos running. But if you look at, you know, what's a more realistic outlook, I think there's roughly $50 trillion in funds under advice. I think we're going to get probably close to 5% of that to come into Bitcoin. That's $2.5 trillion that's going to fit into roughly a $500 billion market cap. If you think that there's only 1 million coins on exchange, you know, you basically divide $5 trillion by 1 million Bitcoin, and I think you end up with $5 billion of Bitcoin.
5 million per Bitcoin?
5 billion per Bitcoin.
Is that a B or M? Billion?
No, it's 5 million, sorry. 5 okay, million okay. of yeah, Bitcoin. Yeah. So all of a sudden, I mean, that's what the market cap is, and you extrapolate the market cap out on the back of it. It looks like, what is it? That'd be a 1.5. That'd be 150x increase from here. But there was only a 5x increase in the market cap. So you put $2.5 trillion into a $500 billion, and it led to a 125x increase.
Yeah, I mean that. To me, that makes sense logically. And I'm excited to see people fact check the fat finger trade you're talking about.
That's
a good problem to have if you can accidentally buy $100 million worth of Bitcoin.
Wouldn't we all be happy doing that? And this is where this multiplier, the multiplier changes depending on a few things. Firstly, the demand is obviously the biggest thing that drives that multiplier. If you're trying to fit, you know, $1 billion worth of trades into one day, it's going to be very difficult and you're going to blow the price out. So the multiplier is going to be far bigger. Conversely, if you're sitting on supply and, you know, we do a really great job of getting all the coins off exchange and we move the coins from 2 million on exchange down to 1 million on exchange, all of a sudden, you know, that $100 million needs to fit into $1 million worth of available coins rather than 2 million. So the multiplier will be twice what it was if the supply was double. And this is where this supply-demand dynamic, we've never seen absolute digital scarcity with a hard cap of 21 million. And then when you overlay the amount of demand that's going to come into this space, I'm just talking about the institutional and retail money that's going to come into it. But then in addition to that, because it's a nascent asset class, all of a sudden the global indexes that are going to have to purchase this are then going to have to chase that because it's growing at a substantial level and then coming into a level where they're now having to index this in their indexes. So now they're going to have to chase spot Bitcoin to purchase it. And this is where it's sort of a virtuous cycle upwards that, you know, I think these multipliers that we talk of, you know, 10 or 20x, you know, isn't unreasonable to think that we could have that. And if you look at it and compare that to, say, the gold market, the gold market's currently sitting at a $14 trillion market cap and Bitcoin's at $500 billion, so it'd be a 14x increase in price from here. You know, would that be unreasonable in this market? Probably not. And ironically, and as unpopular as this might sound, you know, all of a sudden that whole stock-to-flow model where Bitcoin's stock-to-flow is greater than gold, you know, all of a sudden has relevance again.
Yeah, definitely. And one more factor that we haven't even touched on is the fact that there's going to be more units of dollars and other fiat currencies thrown into the market over the next decade. So all of that could make our numbers just way off on the low end. I know you're really dialing in and focused on the collaborative custody, but I'm sure you're also still paying attention to the macro scene. What is your sort of medium term outlook? And then what's your longer term macro thesis? Do you buy into the debt spiral at all? And what are your overall thoughts on macro?
Macro is a difficult beast to really understand. It's something I wouldn't say I've given up on it, but I have a lot less confidence in it. And that's because the truth makers in the space, being the Federal Reserve, are no longer truth makers. They make up numbers just like, you know, the CCP does for the Chinese numbers. And this is a real shame. And I'll sort of give three reasons in the last 2 years that have happened for that. In November 21, we had one or two directors of the Federal Reserve stood down for insider trading. You know, these guys are worth tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars in the most prestigious, you know, corporate settings, a Federal Reserve board member. And they still felt the need to front run a position and insider trade. It's completely disgusting. Then fast forward 6 months, we had, was it April, May 21, we had Jay Powell come out and say that inflation was transitory, when even Blind Freddie knew that inflation was not transitory. And then the death blow for me was in, excuse me, in June last year, we told the unemployment numbers were good and strong. And then fast forward to December last year, December 22, we had the Philly Fed come out, a sub-branch of the Federal Reserve come out, who's responsible for the unemployment numbers, and they acknowledged that they had missed 1.1 million unemployed from 6 months earlier. I mean, these people aren't even trying.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is the framework that we build all of our macro analysis on. It's like, guys... they're just lying to you. Why are you playing the game? It's really disappointing. But, you know, to play the game, I look at this and I think, in light of the bullshit that they pull, you need to understand that there are things that they can think of and do that we have no comprehension is even possible. So I look at this debt spiral and everyone's concerned about it and tells us it's going to be hyperinflation, catastrophizes it and tells us how bad the US dollar is. The US dollar is still better than every other currency out there. You know, you're not taking the Russian ruble, you're not taking the Chinese yuan, you're not taking the Indian rupee, you know, the Japanese yen. Like, please, the US dollar is the king and it's not going to change anytime soon. And this is where everyone's so concerned about the debt spiral, thinking that the debt's out of control and you can't pay that down, and how they're going to get out of it. You know, I can tell you two ways they can get out of it tomorrow. They can basically buy all the paper, you know, buy all the bonds that they're issuing. And guess what? You know what's happening in the bond market right now? All of the bonds are going no bid. No one's buying them. So who's buying them? The Federal Reserve. So what are they going to do? They're sitting on a shitload of losses at the moment. But all they've got to do to make good on those bonds is drop the rates down to zero. And all of a sudden, they've paid off all the country's debt. Now, you don't think they're capable of doing that? Of course they are. They could do that in a heartbeat. That's on the debt side of the balance sheet. We haven't even talked about the asset side of the balance sheet. So how do you fix a debt problem? It's simple. You just adjust the assets upwards. And then all of a sudden, the debt to GDP ratio or the debt to asset ratio isn't a problem. So there's multiple levers that they can pull. And I just don't think, you know, I think we give them too much credit for being good faith actors when they're prepared to do anything, because if they don't do it, it's an existential threat to them and they no longer exist. So people backed into a corner make decisions that they're not overly proud of.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And if you just look at the origin of the Federal Reserve, they weren't created with good intentions to do right by humanity. They were created to keep the bankers rich. So to expect that that has somehow changed over the last 111 years is kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, I think we're missing the big picture as to what's really happening here with the banks. I think there's a real battle going on between the Federal Reserve and the ECB, and that's borne out with the SOFR market v. the LIBOR market, and they're basically going to keep jacking up rates until the ECB crumbles.
Interesting. So it'll make George Soros look, his attack look like much less than if the Federal Reserve conducts an attack on a foreign central bank then. How do you think, do you think we get like a CBDC? Does the rest of the world go onto like a dollar CBDC one day? What are your thoughts on that?
I think that has to happen. Because what the Federal Reserve's doing is with the SOFR markets, the SOFR market was created to wrestle control from the European banks setting LIBOR rates. So the London Interbank Offer Rate was how the US dollar, the US rates were set. And that was set in London. Now, SOFR, you know, Secured Overnight Funding Rate is basically set up in competition to LIBOR. And it's a better form of system because they firstly pay you more interest and there's no counterparty risk. Your counterparty is the Federal Reserve, not the European banks. So I look at this and I think what that's doing is that's drawing the best collateral out of the euro dollar market and sending it to the US. It's onshoring that the best collateral on earth is going to the SOFA market to be looked after because that's the best place for your capital. It's the least risky and you get the best interest rate. So I look at this and I think the ECB has got a major problem when it comes to a collateral, like quality collateral. And, you know, this is probably too early to think about this, but this is where Bitcoin becomes the best form of collateral ever invented. And when Bitcoin gets, you know, that collateral status globally, this is where there's an untold amount of weight of money that needs to come into this market to make good on that collateral. So, you know, another vector that will send a huge amount of capital into Bitcoin. But you know, the big picture is capital is coming out of the euro dollar market and it's being onshore to the US. That's why I think you've seen the Dixie go from 100 to 106 and a half in the last 3 or 4 months. I think the US dollar strength is going to continue. And you know what's really weird to look at in the last, say, 2 or 3 months is that that US dollar's like absolutely strengthened, you know, quite comprehensively. At the same time, gold's cracked 2,000. That's a really odd situation that you've got the US dollar and gold going up in unison.
Yeah, I guess you would think theoretically people would rush to one or the other as a flight to safety instead of both.
Yep, but that tells me that someone's getting screwed here and it looks like Europe and the euro dollar market and everyone attached to it. So everyone but the US.
Interesting. I never really think about, you know, anything other than just like the U.S. markets and trying to understand the European markets. I'll definitely have to go back and listen to this.
Don't worry about it. They're inconsequential. Yeah. They're going to be less consequential moving forward too.
That's savage. So yeah. A question I've heard on Twitter, and it's something I don't have to think about, is if Bitcoin didn't exist, where would you allocate capital? But as a financial advisor, that is something you have to think about, because not all your clients are going to get 100% Bitcoin. So given the current landscape and all the uncertainties that we face, other than Bitcoin, if Bitcoin doesn't exist, where are you hiding your wealth? Where are you going to save it for the future for the next 5-10 years?
It's really hard. That's a question I've wrestled with for the last 2 years. Literally since November 11, 2021, we have had huge issues determining where is the best place for capital, because you know when we make decisions, we're not making trades for clients. We're typically, you know, creating strategies that are going to be 5 to 10 year strategies for where that capital is best placed. And you look around the globe and you look at what's happening right now. You know, China effectively in a recession. Yes, they're pumping liquidity, which is a positive, but really don't like their property rights, so it's very difficult to look at their bond. I mean, their bond markets are shocking and their stock market's not much better. You go to Europe, the stock market in Europe, you know, there's not many stocks, maybe a handful of stocks you'd want to own in Europe, but it's a total basket case. Germany's, you know, just absolutely destroying itself with horrible energy policy that's going to have, you know, long-term ramifications. They need to do a U-turn, but, you know, they're held captive by that Greens party there. And, you know, you look at France and then the UK is a basket case. There's not too many companies I'd want to own there. You know, the US actually looks pretty good, and technology, as beaten up as it has been in the last 2 years, is, you know, probably some of, if not the best place for capital right now. And what's really interesting about, you know, growth stocks and particularly the technology stocks is something, and I haven't really heard anyone else talk about this, but something very strange happened in around 2010. Pre-2010, growth stocks were typically very high working capital requirements and high debt issuance. And so they were exceptionally sensitive to interest rate rises. However, what's happened over the last 40 years, particularly with value stocks, is that they have financially engineered their balance sheets to be more efficient. And what that means is they've had a lot more share buybacks, they've taken a lot more debt, they've gotten rid of the lazy balance sheet mentality. And all of a sudden, these value stocks, per se, have taken on a huge amount of debt that they otherwise wouldn't look at. And, you know, probably the most egregious example of this, of, you know, sort of capital mismanagement in the last 20 years, I'd say, is have a look at IBM. Last time I checked, it's got a market cap of about $127 billion. And in the last 20 years, maybe a little bit longer, they've had share buybacks of over $120 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you heard that right. So once you get to the year 2010, what's really interesting is, fast forward, you have the rise of, you know, the stocks like Google, Facebook, and the FANGs. And all of a sudden, they've got zero marginal cost per additional unit of production. And so they are wildly cash accretive, and they're growth stocks. So
yeah,
post 2010, all of a sudden, the growth stocks are the one with no debt, no working capital requirements, and huge cash balances sitting on their balance sheet. And so this is where, despite the last 12 months being, you know, wildly volatile, or the last 2 years being wildly volatile for the growth stocks, because you've had a price earnings compression. What's been really interesting is that they're actually sitting on piles of cash, and they're still producing a lot of cash, whereas all of the value companies have, you know, basically sitting on piles of debt, and their margins are getting eked out. And so to really highlight just how upside down the world was and how difficult this job is to, you know, allocate capital at this point in time, if we go back to the beginning of the year, we had arguably the greatest value stock of all time and one of Warren Buffett's favorites, Coca-Cola.
Mm-hmm.
He bought Coca-Cola in the mid-1980s, trading at a 6 to 7 times price earnings ratio. At the beginning of this year, you could buy Coca-Cola with a 30 times price earnings multiple.
Jeez.
To put this into perspective, Microsoft at the time was at 23 times price earnings. Facebook was at 15 times price earnings.
Mm.
Please make this market make sense to me.
Yeah,
and I'm sitting here trying to allocate capital, and I'm like, how does this make any sense? It doesn't. And so it's upside down world. You know, Facebook at 15 times PE when Coca-Cola's at 30 is great. And, you know, you look what's happened in the last few months, or last 6 months, with Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola's fallen off a cliff. It's down 20%, and the price earnings multiples dropped from 30 to 23. The reason why people were buying Coca-Cola at the start of the year, because it was a bond proxy. It was paying 3%, but it was an inflation-adjusted hedge because it's Coca-Cola and, you know, commands a premium, has a moat. So point being is it's really difficult at this point in time. Outside of short-term bonds and Bitcoin, it's really hard to get excited about anything because, you know, we've covered off on the stock market and how difficult that is. And I think there are opportunities starting to emerge, but it's much, much harder than, you know, to look at. And then, you know, you look at commercial property and property in general. I look at that and I think there is a huge problem in valuations at the moment. You've got air between, you know, what people think it's worth or what the bank think it's worth and what people are prepared to pay. And so we've got to find this, you know, this price discovery. But with interest rates and 30-year rates where they are, the residential and the commercial sector is going to have huge trouble actually meeting and coming to terms and trading because, you know, it's difficult to trade when the rates have gone up so much. So I don't think I've done a really good job of answering your question. I've talked for a long time, but what I need to say is it's just very, very difficult outside of short-term bonds, with no duration risk, and Bitcoin, it's hard to get any sort of conviction in an investment.
Yeah, thankfully we do have Bitcoin, so we're not just like completely out in the water with only short-term bonds to cling on to. Peter, I know it's late over in the land down under, so we can go ahead and start wrapping up here. Where can you send the audience?
Sure thing. I'm on Twitter at PeterBTCAdvisor with an ER. My DMs are open. If you've got any questions, please hit me up there. Or alternatively, you can check out our website, thebitcoinadvisor.com, and that is advisor with an ER. There's a host of information on collaborative custody. We'd love to help you. And even if we can't help you, there's a host of information for you to action for yourself to help give you the confidence to get your Bitcoins off exchange. Whether or not we help with that, there's a host of resources which will give you the confidence to do it. So hope you can use those.
Awesome. Thank you for coming on, Peter. Actually, I have one more question before I forget. Yeah. I ask this to everyone. What does Bitcoin mean to you?
Hope. It represents hope. I think I'd be very disillusioned in light of all of my understanding of traditional financial markets and what I've seen, the behavior, you know, lack of good behavior in market participants on a global institutional retail level. In the last few years, it's been a degradation of trust. And this is where, you know, a hard money with Bitcoin, a set of rules, not rulers, really gives me hope for the future that if humanity can adopt that, it's going to be a better future for all of us. So I'd say hope.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Thanks for coming on, Peter.
Thanks, Mitch. Appreciate it.